This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Scientists expect the waters of North Carolina's coast to rise about 1 meter by the end of the century. Roughly 2,000 miles of the state's coastline is only 1 meter or less above sea level, so you can expect some changes to the shape of the state in the east. The Outer Banks could be torn to pieces. Thousands of homes are threatened. And of course, the end of the century is a long way off, but the coastal sea level is rising now, and the effects are already evident. Joining us from a studio at Western North Carolina Public Radio to talk about those effects is Rob Young. He is director of the Program for the Study of Developed Shorelines at Western Carolina University. Rob, welcome.
Welcome.
Good to have you on the program. And if there's any doubt about the urgency, we can know that there should be no doubt, because there you are studying the coast from Western Carolina University. So you're expecting the shore there any day now, I guess. we mentioned there up in the mountains, we talked about a 1 meter rise by the end of the century. First of all, how do you figure that out?
Well, that is that number comes from a report that was prepared by the Science Advisory Council to the Coastal Resources Commission. And that comes from a combination of looking at the current rate of sea level rise and projecting that into the future. But the larger scientific community expects an acceleration in the current rate of sea level rise due to an increased rate of warming and an increased contribution to the volume of the ocean from the great ice sheet. So there's an expectation that there will be an increased contribution to ocean water from melting of Greenland and Antarctica. So the 1 meter number that you've mentioned is sort of a suggested planning number that coastal communities in Eastern North Carolina and around the globe should be preparing or at least thinking for the possibility of an increase in sea level of about 1 meter by the end of the century.
All right. Now, how are the effects of that rise in sea level being seen already? Are they?
Well, you know, one thing that folks should understand is that sea level rise isn't something that's theoretical. It's been going on for the last century. It's something that we're directly measuring right now via both tide gauges and via satellite. In North Carolina, the rate of sea level rise ranges from about 4 millimeters per year to slightly over 2 millimeters per year in the south. And the reason that we're experiencing coastal erosion in many places is due to the fact that sea level is rising. We also have coastal wetlands that are migrating landward across eastern North Carolina. If you go to many coastal marshes, you'll see that there's a rim of dead trees on the upland margin of those wetlands. Well, that's direct evidence that sea level is rising. And, you know, we also have areas that in eastern North Carolina that no longer perk and where the fields are draining much more slowly in the springtime because the water table is backing up. All of these are pieces of evidence that sea level rise is, in fact, something that is happening today. It's going to continue to happen into the future. And there's a strong likelihood that that rate of rise is going to accelerate.
Now, when you talked about the 1 meter figure being a planning tool, plan how? What do you do if you know that the sea level is going to be a meter higher in a century?
Well, you know, I guess it really depends on the type of activity that you need to be planning for. So, you know, right now the rate of sea level rise is, you know, it's about 4 millimeters per year at the most in the North Carolina coast. And that acceleration that scientists expect is not happening at the moment. So if you're building a single family home, then, you know, maybe the fact that sea level is rising is going to have very little impact on your decision making if you're in eastern North Carolina. If you're siting an airport or a nuclear power plant, then, you know, probably building that in any area that could be impacted by a sea level rise of 1 meter would be a bad idea. The other thing that understanding that sea level rise is something that's real and is happening now, the other thing that coastal communities need to keep in mind is that means all of the erosion problems and the coastal management problems that we're experiencing today are not going to go away, and they're only going to get worse, and they're only going to get more costly to deal with. And, you know, I think that that's really what coastal communities need to keep in the back of their minds as they're planning for the future.
And all of this is directly related to what we know as global warming, which is the human effect of mainly burning fossil fuels and other things on this planet. It's making things warmer and melting the ice sheets. You're convinced of that?
Yes, there's absolutely no question that the planet is getting warmer. I mean, there's just no room for discussion about that fact. The planet is clearly getting warmer. You know, mountain glaciers are retreating globally. Permafrost is disappearing. We have so many lines of evidence that point to the fact that the planet is getting warmer. You don't even need to look at temperature data. You know, the Earth provides us with many different lines of evidence that shows that the planet is unquestionably getting warmer. I believe that there's still a little bit of room for discussion as to the exact role that humans are playing. Are we driving 100% of that warming? Are we driving 50% of that warming? But there's no question that the planet's getting warmer. And the vast scientific consensus is that humans are playing a very important role in that warming.
And rising sea levels is one effect. Along the coast of North Carolina, we're also seeing damage done by global warming. And then out in the deeper ocean, the effects are evident as well. Water temperature is rising. Sea life is adapting to a new kind of environment. Joining us now is John Bruno. He's an associate professor in the Department of Biology at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, co-authored an article that appeared in Science magazine last June. The article details how climate change is affecting life in the ocean. John, welcome.
Hi, Frank. How are you?
Good, good. Some of the debate about global warming treats the subject as almost theoretical. And as you heard Rob say, he's pretty convinced. Are you convinced that global warming is a real scientific fact?
Oh, absolutely. There's no question. And the signals of it impacting the oceans is becoming increasingly clear as well. In fact, I like to call it ocean change rather than climate change. About 90% of the additional heat content that's being absorbed by the Earth due to greenhouse gas emissions goes into the ocean, not the land or the atmosphere. And that has all kinds of profound impacts on ocean ecosystems.
Give us a sample.
So just the fact that the oceans are warming, they've warmed about 2 degrees Fahrenheit on average over the last 4 or 5 decades, changes the metabolism of ocean organisms. So metabolism, how fast things operate, is profoundly linked with temperature. So a slight rise in temperature, everything speeds up. They need more energy. They swim faster. It just really fundamentally alters how food webs work. In that temperature acts as a barrier to where species live. It really has a profound effect on species ranges. And so here's a really frightening example. In the Antarctic, we have this amazing community underwater on the benthos that's been the way it is for about 40 million years. So it's a very kind of pre-Cambrian type community. There's no big bone-crushing predators. There's no sharks. There's no rays, no skates. And the community there has evolved, just never adapted to predators. Warming is going to allow sharks into that community. Right now, they're restricted from the cold water. A degree and a half sea of warming, and you're going to have a lot of sharks down there. We already have king crabs moving in. And that whole community that's been there for, you know, tens of millions of years is just going to be totally wiped out, totally devastated.
Also, big changes in the way nutrients are distributed in the ocean.
Yeah, so we're seeing changes in stratification. So we're seeing increased layering that is reducing the upwelling of nutrients from deep water into shallow water, and that affects primary production, which is just photosynthesis by small phytoplankton, and that has all kinds of implications for fisheries. We, you know, really depend on that primary production to create food for the fish that we eat down the line.
Now, isn't this just a matter of adjustment? That this has been the history of this planet. Species come, species go, changes happen, plate tectonics. There was once one big continent, now we've got many. This is all part of the process of evolution on this planet.
It is. It certainly has happened in the past. There's been radical changes, radical extinctions. It's never happened remotely this quickly. It's going to happen in our lifetimes, not, you know, over the next million years is what the rate these changes typically operate over. And regardless, it's still foolish to cause them. It's like saying, well, I'm going to die eventually, so I shouldn't wear a seatbelt or a bike helmet when I'm riding my bike. You know, I don't want to die tomorrow.
And the rate of change is significant. The fact that these things are happening so quickly is different, although there have been fast, quick extinctions, certainly.
There have.
On the planet. And Rob, when we talk about the sea level change, there's also this has an impact on storm drainage and also some of the plant life along the coast, particularly the life that controls erosion.
You know, one of the tricky parts about rising sea level is that means that all of our coastal environments, from the near shore to the beach to the barrier island to the estuary to the wetlands, have to be able to slide landward in response to that rising sea level if we want to keep them around. So one of the greatest threats of rising sea level is the disappearance of coastal wetlands in North Carolina and, you know, other states, South Carolina, Florida, and Louisiana. We have developed many of the areas that fringe the wetlands in eastern North Carolina. And if those wetlands are able to respond naturally, they will expand into the upland and we'll still have them. And they're very valuable from many, you know, many different perspectives. However, if those wetlands are bumping up against a road or a building or a bulkhead or a seawall, then they will simply disappear as sea level continues to rise. And that's a big problem.
On the state of things today, we're talking about global warming and its effects on the ocean, effects that are already being felt on North Carolina's coast. Our guests are Rob Young, director of the Program for the Study of Developed Shorelines at Western Carolina University, John Bruno's associate professor in the Department of Biology at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Just ahead, did a small group of men launch the campaign to convince the public that global warming doesn't exist? We'll find out on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio, talking today about global warming and its effects on the ocean and North Carolina's coast, effects that are already being felt. We've been talking to Rob Young. He's the director of the Program for the Study of Developed Shorelines at Western Carolina University. John Bruno is associate professor in the Department of Biology at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Joining us now is Naomi Oreskes. She is a professor of history and and science studies at the University of California, San Diego. She's also the author of Merchants of Doubt, How a Handful of Scientists Obscured the Truth on the Issues from Tobacco Smoke to Global Warming. She's going to be speaking tonight at 7 o'clock at the FedEx Global Education Center at UNC Chapel Hill, but she is with us now. Naomi, welcome. Good to have you here.
Good to be here. Thank you.
We have been talking about the effects of global warming with some certainty. But this is science. Nothing is certain in science. And you take a look at some news articles, and there seems to be doubt about global warming. Why?
Well, the news media has really misrepresented this question. In the media, it's very popular to describe something as a conflict because that makes a story. If we have a story, well, all scientists agree, then that's not a story for most journalists. But the reality is that essentially all scientists do agree. Scientists have been working on this issue for more than half a century. The predictions of global warming date back to the 1950s and even before. And what we're seeing now is that the predictions that scientists made in the 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s are now coming true.
Well, and the research goes back even farther than that. I mean, I think the other impression that we get is Al Gore not only invented the internet, but he also invented global warming. In fact, the research and the discovery that there's something going on here goes back to the turn of the 20th century.
Yeah, well, scientists first suggested the possibility of global warming at the turn of the century. It became a subject of sustained scientific research starting in the 1950s with the International Geophysical Year. And that's when Roger Revelle, who was the mentor to Al Gore, first obtained funding for scientists to begin to systematically measure carbon dioxide in the atmosphere in order to test whether or not increasing carbon dioxide would have these effects. Al Gore learned about this from Roger Revelle when he was a professor at Harvard. And of course, what we know today, now more than 50 years later, is that yes, indeed, carbon dioxide has increased dramatically, measurably. And yes, indeed, the predicted effects are happening.
Yeah, that's the interesting thing. We've made an observation around the turn of the century, started to predict what might happen, made predictions, then measured that. And it turns out that and in fact, the predictions have been a little bit conservative, not alarmist. In fact, they've been a little bit wrong, but they've erred on the side of caution.
Exactly. A lot of people who are skeptical about climate change or who don't want to accept the necessity to change our energy system like to accuse scientists of being alarmist, hysterical, overreacting, trying to get more money for their research. And what we actually see by looking at it historically is that the opposite is true. We see that scientists have actually been fairly cautious, which is typical of scientists, fairly conservative. Scientists are intrinsically conservative about scientific claims, and that if you look back now and analyze the predictions that were made in some of the earlier reports, we find that most of those predictions are actually erring on the low side, and we're seeing that the rates of sea level rise, rates of temperature increase, are actually happening faster than most scientists thought true back in the 1970s and 80s.
Rob, let me ask you if you think that some of the confusion now about global warming, if scientists can take some of the responsibility, maybe for not getting the word out, maybe for not being clear enough about exactly what it was, what we're looking at.
Well, you know, I think one of the problems that we have in the scientific community is that we don't do a very good job of talking to everybody about why climate change matters. You know, there's a significant segment of our society that unfortunately gets their information about climate change from outlets like Glenn Beck and Rush Limbaugh. And we sit around and we moan about that quite a bit, but we don't put very much energy, in my opinion, into figuring out how we can replace those talking heads with our own line of communication to folks that aren't actively skeptical, who might be won over, but are just regular listeners to the side that's telling the skeptic's story. You know, not everyone in America cares that we may lose polar bears because there's a diminishing Arctic ice and they're not going to be able to catch seals. But there are a lot of folks that might care that in 20 or 30 years, we won't be able to farm tobacco anymore east of the Suffolk Scarp in eastern North Carolina, that we may not be able to plant cotton and soybeans in those areas. And I think we need to do a better job. We scientists need to do a better job of framing the debate and bringing it home to people in a way that they can understand.
Well, let me take an element of that question, Rob, but put it to John and ask you to speculate. People are concerned about whether they're going to farm and what's going to happen to their coast, but they sense that global warming and human activity has nothing to do with it and we shouldn't be scared if they deny this. And part of the reason is they think that the issue has become political, that some group called environmentalists who are politicized are the ones who are sounding the alarm. How do you answer that, and how would you counter that impression that it's a sided group already that's raised the flag here?
Yeah, the issue has become very political. Naomi and I were just talking about this last night at dinner, and it's kind of frustrating because it's just the atmospheric temperature. Why is that a Democrat or a Republican issue? It's the environment. And it's sad that it's become so politicized, and it makes it really tricky for scientists to, you know, have a discourse with the public about it.
But so, I think if I could jump in here, it's really, really important for the public to understand that this issue has become political, but it's not the scientists who made it political.
That's right.
Scientists have been working for decades, publishing in peer-reviewed journals, going to conferences, doing their scientific thing. And the politicization of this issue has been done, and this is what our book is all about, because the politics is part of the story, like it or not. The politicization has come from people with very strong interests who don't want to accept the scientific evidence because they don't like the implications of what it means for how we do business in the United States.
In Merchants of Doubt, you talk about the rise of the George C. Marshall Institute in particular as one group that may have had a hand in politicizing this. Tell us about that group and its foundation.
Yeah. So my co-author, Eric Conway, and I were both historians. We were really interested in this issue of why climate science had become politicized and why there was the impression among the American people that this was a big debate when it was quite clear that scientifically it really wasn't a debate at all. And so we traced this back. We did 5 years of research to try to understand where this had come from. And what we were able to show in the book was that it really began with a rather small handful of people who created a tank called the George C. Marshall Institute. And originally, the institute had nothing to do with climate change. It was an anti-communist institute, a group of scientists, physicists, who had worked on Cold War weapons and rocketry programs, the hydrogen bomb, the atomic bomb, rocketry, satellites, space program.
Well-respected scientists.
Very well-respected scientists who were deeply anti-communist and who strongly supported the idea of a strong defense, a strong military position to fight communism. And they became politicized during the debate over strategic defense, what we know as Star Wars. And they created the Marshall Institute to defend the need for Star Wars against the Soviet threat. Now, that was in 1984 when the Soviet Union still existed. The strange thing about this story was that only 5 years later, the Berlin Wall fell and the Soviet Union disintegrated and the Cold War was over. So you might have thought that these gentlemen, who were fairly elderly by this time, would have been happy that their life's work had come to such a successful fruition. But instead, they found a new set of reds under the beds. And they began in a almost, you know, slightly paranoid sort of way to see environmentalists as communists in disguise. And they began a systematic campaign to discredit scientific evidence associated with environmental issues. And it wasn't just global warming. It included acid rain, the ozone hole. And they also worked with the tobacco industry. So it's ironic for me that we're here in this tobacco building, because a big part of our story is to show the connections to the tobacco industry and how these men who worked with the tobacco industry, in many cases, not all of them, but several of them, really learned the strategy of challenging scientific data from the tobacco industry.
And what was that strategy? What's the key pillar in that strategy?
Doubt. The strategy is what we call doubt mongering. That's why we call them merchants of doubt. It was simply to sow the seeds of doubt. It wasn't to say the science is all false, all erroneous. It was to say, well, we just don't really know. We're not really sure. There's still a debate. Not all scientists agree. And of course, this was an extremely clever strategy because not all scientists do agree. There's always, you know, there always is discussion. And I disagree with one thing Rob said a minute ago. There's always room for discussion on any scientific issue. And part of being a scientist is being open-minded about the possibility that new data may develop that might make you change your mind. And this is a principal ideal of science, to be open-minded. And scientists are open-minded, and it's part of the strength and the beauty of science. The tobacco industry exploited that. They took this virtue of science and they turned it against it, and then they started amplifying and exaggerating the doubts, trotting out some guy somewhere who didn't agree and say, oh, but look, you know, Mr. Smith, he has a PhD and he doesn't agree, mm-hmm. and make it seem as if there's a big debate. And the really sad part of the story is that journalists fell for this. So journalists began to cover these stories as if they were great debates, quoting these so-called experts who didn't agree, and the public got the impression, for acid rain, for the ozone hole, for global warming, that these were big scientific debates.
Well, let me ask Rob and then John this question, though. How should we cover this? I mean, if there's a legitimate and respected scientist who says, you know, I don't see a link between nicotine and addiction, I don't see a link between tobacco smoke and cancer, do you say, well, there's only one of you and 12 of them, so I'm not going to publish this? I mean, how would you handle it? Let me ask you first, Rob.
Well, you know, one of the problems when you say legitimate and respected scientists, there was an interesting survey that was produced by a group at George Mason University recently. And one of the things that survey indicated in looking both at skeptics and supporters of climate change is that the vast majority of Americans can't name a living scientist. You know, one of the big problems we have is that there is no face, there's no trusted face for the scientific community that can speak to Americans. It's completely different in Canada. The person who's been named the most respected Canadian, and this includes entertainers, politicians across the board for the last couple of years, is a man named David Suzuki. Well, he's a scientist. And so when David Suzuki speaks to Canadian citizens about climate change, people trust and believe what he says. You know, unfortunately, in the U.S., we don't have that same kind of strong scientist that we don't have an Albert Einstein of the day that can speak to the citizenry and have everybody say, I trust what that person says, and so I'm gonna believe it. Instead, this debate has been occurring through the media and through the sort of political circles, and that's a part of the problem. The reason that it's been so politicized, and I'm not quite sure that I know what the solution to that is, but certainly the fact that many Americans can't identify with a scientist is a big part of the problem.
But John, we don't have an Albert Einstein because the whole world of science has changed. There are a lot of people who work in a
thousands.
Very collaborative field these
that's
days,
right.
And they're very likely not to agree, and there are going to be scientists of great stature, all of whom we don't know, and it's true in this country, it's probably our scientific IQ is far too low. But then how do we cover it? I mean, how do you cover the debate? How do you manage debate in the scientific community? You see a paper by a respected scientist, it goes against everything you've found. What do you do with those facts?
And that happens frequently. Like Naomi said, there's openness. We're all open. And we often will send an email to our colleague or call them up and say, I disagree, or have an argument in a hallway at a conference, or you publish a rebuttal, you know, a letter to the editor. So there's frequently. I mean, it's something I do every day just about as a scientist when there's a debatable topic. But, you know, many of the things we're talking about here, there's very little to debate, frankly.
Well, and again, I think the issue is, you know, you just said, what do you do with those facts? And that's really the crux of the issue. Is this just some guy with his opinion, or does he actually have evidence? And what I found with journalists, I think if you think someone has an interesting story to tell, there's nothing wrong with having that person on the air or to be interviewed. But then you have to follow up and you have to say, okay, so what is the evidence to support this conclusion? Where were the peer-reviewed papers published? Where are the National Academy of Sciences reports? You know, where are the NASA satellite data? And what you find with many of these people who claim to be dissenters is they actually have no data. They have no evidence. They just make these claims that are really unsubstantiated. So I think for a journalist, I mean, you have fact checkers, you have people who help, right? It's not that hard. And it's a little shocking to me that this doesn't happen. It's not that hard to simply ask the question, where are the data? Where is the evidence?
And of course, for the dissenters about global warming, there doesn't need to be data. All you have to do, as you suggest in the book, is simply raise doubt. You haven't crossed every T. There's no proof to the nth degree that this exists. I don't need proof to say that.
Right, exactly. So you see that they have a very powerful strategy because doubt works in their favor. And so it's a very it's a big challenge for scientists to say, of course, there isn't proof. Science is not about proof. There's no such thing as absolute proof in science. But what we have is huge amounts of data. I think Rob said this earlier, enormous amounts of data collected by literally thousands of scientists all across the globe using diverse techniques, diverse methods. There is no question, as he said, that the Earth is warming up. And I think there's pretty much no question that the driving force is human activities, mostly greenhouse gases and deforestation.
Yeah, I'll give you an example. The most common argument by climate change skeptics is it's the sun. You hear it over and over again, thousands of times. And you can look on the internet. It's very easy to see that the intensity of the sun's output has been decreasing for several decades while the Earth has been increasing. So, you know, anybody, you know, school kids can check that fact. And yet it goes unchallenged, you know, 100 times a day in the international news media.
Exactly. And these are data.
Well, there's another way to check that, isn't there, Naomi? In other words, if it was the sun, we'd see different results, different measurements up in the troposphere than we do now because the heating would be different. It would be throughout the system, and it wouldn't be located closer to Earth if it was the sun.
Right. This is the story, and that's something
you can measure.
Exactly. And this is the story we begin the book with because, as John correctly said, lots of people invoke the sun because, of course, it's common sense. We all know that the sun is warm, and therefore the sun could warm the Earth, but we know that it hasn't. We have the NASA temperature data. We have satellite data. And as we describe in the book, this key piece of scientific information that was developed in the 1990s. So this is not news. This is old stuff that the structure of the warming of the Earth is not consistent with heating by the sun. We know that that's not true.
And so that leads to burning fossil fuels. There's a correlation between that and keeping the radiation close to Earth, and that's all correlated. What about those who say, yeah, but what do we do about it? After all, the Earth it's a long process. We haven't been there. We haven't been collecting data for the history of the Earth. This might just be one of the natural cycles.
Yeah, well, again, that's a false claim, and we know that that's not true either because we have been collecting data. Scientists have only been collecting data for the last half century, but through studies of paleoclimates, ice cores, marine sediments, we have tremendous amounts of data now going back at least a million years. I was trained originally as a geologist. It's the job of geologists to understand the Earth's history. We have enormous amounts of data that show very clearly that the current warming is distinct and different from what's happened in the past million years and clearly correlated with increased carbon dioxide in the atmosphere.
Rob?
And let's think about this from another perspective. I always like to try and frame arguments in a way that doesn't make me sound like too much of a tree hugger. There are a lot of good reasons to change our energy economy and to move away from burning fossil fuels that have nothing to do with global warming and have everything to do with national security and the incredible destruction wrought by ripping coal out of the ground. And, you know, I live in a part of the world that has very high rates of childhood asthma because we're downdrift of coal-fired power plants. You know, there are a heck of a lot of really good reasons to move away from the way that we use energy right now and from burning fossil fuels that have nothing to do with global warming. And if moving away from that kind of an energy economy happens to solve the global warming problem as well, then that's just icing on the cake.
And that leads to the question, what do you do from a public policy standpoint if the preponderance of evidence and the consensus in the scientific world without the absolute proof is this is happening? What do you do from a public policy standpoint? Do you wait for the last T to be crossed?
Right. Well, and of course, and this is, again, where the politics is part of the story. So, you know, there's a recent report produced by the World Bank that shows that globally – the fossil fuel industry receives $700 billion in subsidies from governments around the globe. So this is a massive socialism for the energy sector that promotes coal, that promotes oil and gas. We don't have to do that. We could change that. We could remove all subsidies. We could shift subsidies to renewables. There are many options that are on the table that are available. But we do have to confront the issue of subsidies. We do have to confront the issue of the power of the coal industry, the oil and gas industry, and the just really strong inertia that keeps us doing business as usual, doing same old, and makes it hard to change.
I want to thank all of you for being on the program today. Naomi Oreskes is a professor of history and science studies at the University of California, San Diego, co-author of Merchants of Doubt, How a Handful of Scientists Obscured the Truth on Issues from Tobacco Smoke to Global Warming. Rob Young is director of the Program for the Study of Developed Shorelines at Western Carolina University. John Bruno, associate professor in the Department of Biology at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Naomi's going to be talking about her book tonight, 7 o'clock, FedEx Global Education Center's Nelson Mandela Auditorium. It's on the campus of UNC Chapel Hill. For more information, go to college.unc.org, and you will find out more about that, or you can just look up Naomi Oreskes or Merchants of Doubt, and you will find out about her talk tonight, 7 o'clock, FedEx Global Education Center. Just ahead, Picasso and Einstein talk genius and creativity. We'll see if global warming came up in their discussion when we talk about the latest at the Art Center in Carrboro. Stay with us.